if I loaded the right one. I hope so. We'll find out. If not, we're going to see what happens. Until about 3 weeks ago, my hypothesis was that Hawaiian print shirts were the sole uniform for grape breeders, and it was an indication of how many you had was how many varieties you released. And as you can see, I don't have one yet. But coming to this conference, I've had to change that hypothesis. I see a lot more of those shirts on people at ASHS, so maybe I have a little bit more time. So I'm from Minnesota, where we have winter. And I start a lot of my talks this way because here's John Toole. He's my vineyard manager, and he also runs his own commercial vineyard in central Minnesota. And he's standing on about 4 feet of snow here, which is actually a good thing because it's protecting a lot of the vines. But it's really just to let you know why we grow grapes in Minnesota. It's a question that comes up a lot, and I'm going to try to answer that shortly. And it's a bit historic, but the biggest reason, I think, is because grapes are there. They were there when the Europeans showed up, and they were certainly there when Native Americans occupied most of this state. And so Vitis riparia exists in Minnesota, and it provides the foundation for the cold hardiness traits that we've integrated into our breeding program over the last 110 years or more. And so when the Europeans were coming in from Germany and other places where they were familiar with grapes and with wine, they wanted to eat and enjoy the fruits that were already available. And they were probably seeing sites like this. This is a spruce tree covered with Vitis riparia. So it was pretty abundant. It's endemic across the state, across the region. And if you have something available, you really want it. And that's certainly true when you don't have sugar available. So in the 1880s or so, when people are trying to establish farms in the Midwest, they wanted to grow apples. They couldn't do that. They didn't have many other fruits available to them. So their sources for sugar were probably maple, if they could find a plot of land that had some of that, or honey, if they had their own bees. But they were really limited to what they had. And if those immigrants were anything like my family that established their way into Iowa, they found grapes, so they wanted to do something with it. So my mom is carrying on that tradition. She cans grapes. These are Concord, of course. Concord found its way with those immigrants into the state. But you know what? It didn't survive so well in Minnesota. It did okay in Iowa, but it didn't make it much further in the north. And so I think people really liked fruit for a number of different reasons, as I've indicated, but primarily because it tasted good, and maybe they didn't have access to other resources. And our program at Minnesota really transitioned from this situation, jams, jellies, and juice, at the turn of the last century, to wine production in the 1970s. And so that's kind of the story that I'm going to tell today, is where we've transitioned to. And a lot of this has to do with people. And so, as you'll see in a lot of my slides, they're the number one audience, is our stakeholders, and so that's who I'm going to really focus on. University of Minnesota has developed a few wine grape cultivars. Frontenac was the first that came out in 1996, so we've only had about 20 years of growing that variety. So we're pretty new to this, and so the learning curve in producing wine and grapes is long and steep, and we are still trying to figure things out. So we had Frontenac that came out that was noir, or a black grape. It's since mutated, which is great because it offers some new variety for wine styles. So now we have a gris as well as a blanc. Le Crescent, Marquette, and I sort of lied. We do have a new variety that we pushed out in the last year and a half that I came into this position called Itasca, which we have really elevates the types of wines that are produced in the region. So there's a lot of perceptions and some of the misperceptions about Midwest wines, that they're sour, they're sweet, they're foxy, they're hybrid, they're low quality, they're church wine, that people make them in 1 gallon batches with a balloon on top. All of these things are true. And some of those things are favorable. And I'll just mention this church wine thing. I think most people in the Midwest, if you're not from a city, that's your only experience to wine before you turn 21. And so church wine can be all of those things. And if you grew up Methodist like me for part of my life, your church wine wasn't even wine. It was grape juice because they don't drink wine in that church. So people don't know what wine is until they visit a city or they start seeing it in movies. And so their experience is very different. The reality is that wines in the Midwest are pretty diverse. We have reds, whites, rosés, aromatics, ice wine, dessert wines. We have ciders. We have fruit wines. If you can turn it into a wine, they do. I've heard about Mountain Dew wine. I've heard about tomato wine. If it has sugar in it, someone's going to turn it into wine. they're nuanced. Some are good, some are bad. They're different. They're not going to be the Malbecs, the Merlots, and the Chardonnays. And that's okay. Something we've realized is that the local consumer wants to have something that's unique, that is endemic of a place, that represents Minnesota or Iowa or Wisconsin or Vermont. And our wines do that. They have a signature that is just of this place. The unfortunate reality is that there is a range of quality. We have things that are fantastic and award-winning, and we have things that shouldn't be in your mouth longer than maybe a second or so. And that's really the problem in this state. If you've tasted a bad wine, or you decided you're going to spend your afternoon traveling around to different wineries, and the first one is some bad examples of Minnesota wines, you're not going to go to the winery 2 miles down the road, and you may never go back to tasting a Minnesota wine again. And that's the real problem, is that the perception about Midwest wines comes from the 1970s and 80s, and maybe before that, before the new varieties came into the marketplace. So we have to work really, really hard to promote these wines and the industry. And it's hard to do that from an academic perspective and from a university, and how do we best spend our resources. So one way that I've really thought about doing that is developing a community of practice. So thinking about our stakeholders as groups of people who have a skill set, and how to really develop that as a way to make them compete better with wine that's imported into the state, as opposed to competing with one another and trying to hold trade secrets, or things that they think are trade secrets, kind of close to the chest. So we work with growers, winemakers, and also scientists. So there's people like me who have an extension position, but I don't do any viticulture. I don't know why I do extension, because I'm a breeder geneticist, but I have a role. So my goal is to try to get people together who know what the heck they're talking about. So we work on improving communication. So we use websites, we use a Google group that works really, really well for our stakeholders who can communicate, and it's going when I go to bed and I wake up and there are more things. And that's great, because they're talking to one another. The problem is, are they sharing the right information, or is it scientifically based? And so that's where I can often interject and really get information into people, out to people that they can use, as opposed to just maybe some hearsay about a best approach. Again, with the real emphasis of how do we share knowledge. So we can do community building. Wine really lends itself to that in a really fun sort of way. These guys are having a great time. I don't know if you can see the picture on the right, but it's a tornado shelter. We were actually having an event and had a tornado warning, so we grabbed our wine, went downstairs to the basement of our research facility, and got to hang out and drink wine and talk about our industry. What better way to find out what's going on is to get people from across our region into a very small space with some bottles of wine. Not everything is this fun, but it's a good starting place. So when you start a job like this, at least I was warned, fortunately, by my department head, is don't get overrun by hobbyists and homeowners who grow one grapevine or two or even 10, because they will suck up all of your time. And I see some people nodding their heads that, yeah, this is true. So my goal in my first year in this position was to empower as many master gardeners as possible with the tools of how to grow grapes, whether it was just primarily is like what varieties can be grown and don't grow them in the shade. Like those are the two things that people really do wrong. The third is how to prune, and that's something that I think everybody's scared about. Grapevines are very responsive to pruning, and just prune them until they do what you want them to. If you're a homeowner, that's fine. You're going to get most of your fruit from the grocery store. We try to do as much outreach as possible. Some of this is not necessarily extension programming, but as much information as we can get out when necessary, especially with timely bulletins. Last year, we encountered some major rain events in August and September, and so we had a lot of issues that hadn't happened before in Minnesota with fruit rots, breakdown, fruit flies. People actually just couldn't get into their fields to do any spraying. They could barely get into harvest. People having 15 inches of rain in a 24-hour period is sort of unheard of in August in Minnesota. So we had to get information out as quickly as possible. We like to do field days. I don't like to do field days. My staff love to do field days because they get to show off all of their hard work. For me, it's a challenge to get in front of people who ask a lot of questions that are basic. That's really hard for me, but it's also really fun to show off the hard work of people who work on the project. So here's an example of Carl Rosen. He's a soil nutritionist from the University of Minnesota, a great extension fellow, and he is talking to our audience about some of the most recent research in that area. And you can see around the table we have fruit that are put out, so a lot of people like to come and taste the fruit and make some decisions about what they like to grow. And we talk about diseases, insect pests. A lot of the people in this audience are actually just homeowners and people from the neighborhood who just are kind of snoopy, but it's a really good way to have positive PR leaving our facility. One thing that we did last year was do a pruning workshop. It's not that many people, as you can see, but that was by design. These are actually all grad students from North Dakota, Iowa State, and from Minnesota. And so our goal was to inform and educate people who work on these projects in fruit and primarily in grape who may not get the expertise locally. And so this has been something that I've been developing with Diana Cochran at Iowa State and Harleen, and having these ongoing conversations, how do we train students so that they can go out and spread the word about how to grow grapes. Right now, kind of one person in this picture is the expert for the entire region about how to prune, and that's not fair to him, and it's not fair to the rest of us. So now we have about 11 people who know how to prune and how to do it well. Annually, we have the Minnesota Grape Growers Association puts on a cold climate conference, and this is a great opportunity for us to get a bunch of people in the room who grow these varieties and arm them with the best tools to make the best wines. The picture I'm showing here is a Brianna tasting. We were looking at harvest date in Brianna. I can't imagine anyone here knows that variety, but the longer you wait to pick it, the worse the wines are. And that was the take-home message from this. And so we were able to get a bunch of people in the room, about 60 people, and share that message in a really profound way. So you actually got to taste the wines and then decide, you know what, this is not what I like. There's a few people who really enjoyed that style, but consumer preferences really matched up with what we were discovering. One of the areas that was really underrepresented in the breeding program, and I think one of the reasons my position was actually created, was to provide some new resources about the industry as a whole. And up until last year, there was no crush report. And that's something that's very common in grape-growing regions, how much grapes were produced and what were people paying. We had a lot of growers who were saying, I don't know what to charge for my Frontenac, or should I charge more if it meets certain chemistry parameters, or should I charge more for Frontenac Blanc because there's only 3 acres in the whole state. And so we collected that information, and I think it's been really well received. So I think people are feeling like what the products that they're producing are receiving a fair market value for the efforts that they put in. And we answer some basic questions like, where are grapes even grown in Minnesota? We don't know how many people are growing grapes. It's a hard number to get at. And who knew that we had grapes growing way up north? And we actually have one of our major wineries up there in Alexandria, Minnesota. And so they might be overrepresented there. But we found out several counties of people are growing grapes that we didn't even know about. So this is a really good tool for us. I have an enologist, or a winemaker on staff, Drew Horton, who's implemented winemaker roundtables. Our first one was so successful, we had to split it into 2 days so we can accommodate the number of people who came. And we've been doing these every other month since. So we look at a single variety or a single style of wine like rosé, and we bring in winemakers from around the region. It's participation has dwindled a bit, but that's because winemakers are pretty busy for about 4 months out of the year, and the rest of the time they're growing grapes in many cases. And so we have about 15 people who show up on average. They sit around, they taste their wines blind compared to the rest of the participants, and they sit there and talk and belittle their own wines, which is great. This is really getting at the problem of perception. Winemakers often have pretty big egos. Grape growing and winemaking is this echelon of accomplishment, or sometimes it's perceived that way. And so this event really gets to the heart of, is my product good or not, and what can I do differently? After our first event, one of our more outspoken, accomplished winemakers said, he wins great awards on his white wines and not on his reds. And our first tasting was for some red wines, and he said, I learned today that I'm doing something wrong and I need to change. And like, that's the biggest impact you can hear when doing an event like this. Especially because he's on a lot of people's radars and he's on a popular highway. So getting him to change using plastic fermentation vessels to stainless steel, which is what he needs to do, for him to say that himself was a huge accomplishment. Plus, he has a big ego, and it's really hard to tell someone how to change when that's the case. So that's a bit about the winemaking side of things. I'm a great breeder, plant breeder by training, and so one of the advantages in working on this project is that it's been going on for 110 years, working on table grapes and multi-use grapes until the 1970s, and then we transitioned into wine grapes at that point in time. As you saw in some of the earlier slides, the juvenility period is long in perennial crops. Grapevine is 3 to 5 years, so that's not as long as some other species, but it does take a bit of time. So having those resources, especially with cold hardiness kind of built into a lot of the germplasm already, is quite helpful. We have disease resistance alleles in the germplasm already, which is great. It's trying to uncover those and discover them and bring them into high value or highly improved lines is where we're at right now. And in the past 6 years, we've moved from being basically a recurrent selection breeding program, selecting within F1s for tasty things, and making those parents, into using markers to select parents, but also to call our offspring. And I'll talk a little bit about that. This is not for you to read. This is a pedigree that describes all of the crosses that we made in 2015. The takeaway message is that one of the best part about grape breeding is that we have access to almost all of those yellow boxes through germplasm repositories or within our own program. And this sort of represents about 150 years of breeding in France, Germany, and the United States. And we can go back to these individuals if we want to uncover their genetics, to trace the markers through the pedigree. And that's not true in other crops. And so that's really cool about grapes is that people hang on to these lines and that we can continue to access them. So marker-assisted breeding, if you don't know, I use it as a catch-all term to think about using DNA tests to screen parents, to select the best parents based on traits of interest. And then more importantly is the use of those markers to call seedlings in the greenhouse preferentially for those that don't have the trait of interest, because it's pretty expensive for us to move a plant through the entire process, waiting for it to fruit for the first time to find out that it has powdery mildew or that it's a male plant and it's never going to produce fruit. And so we use markers in the greenhouse to really accelerate the breeding timeline. Working in crops like and this type of program is really, I don't want to call it chance, but it is certainly a numbers game. And so if we can put better plants into the field, we can really increase our opportunities for finding new cultivars. This is just a genetic map showing the 19 chromosomes of Vitis. And the red dots represent some known QTL or regions of interest where we're targeting our program. So disease resistance, things like color, flower, sex, are on this map. And there's about 15 on this map, and this would have been about 3 years ago. That's all we knew about grapevine. At the end of VitisGen, which is this SCRI project, this map is now covered with about 75 dots across six or so breeding programs. So we're at a point now where we know a lot about different genetic backgrounds. Now we have to figure out how to start integrating that into our different breeding programs. Unfortunately, Minnesota, it's cold, as you saw on the first slide, and so a lot of those things are going to die pretty quickly and not get integrated. And so we have to come up with new strategies to get that germplasm built in. I'm just going to show two examples of traits that we're interested in. Powdery mildew, we identified two new QTL that have been in the breeding program for a long time, and now we can validate that they actually exist, and we do have mildew resistance. It's not something we really knew for sure. My group has been working on foliar phylloxera. So phylloxera is an insect pest, and I'm going to present on this on Friday afternoon if you want to learn more. But we identified this new region of interest, which is really important because in hybrid grapes, phylloxera infests the leaves, and in Vitis vinifera, they infect the roots. And really no research has been done in this area for the 160 years that we've known about phylloxera. So here's a new area of research. I have a graduate student who's interested in high-throughput phenotyping, so can we take photos of grape clusters and use that as a tool to explore cluster architecture and do some genetic mapping for those traits? This is a very early design that I used, and it worked really well. Now I have someone much smarter working on this project who has a much more elegant system than this one, and so hopefully you'll hear more about that in the next year or two at these meetings. We've moved to doing some embryo rescue. This has been what's really propelled table grape breeding programs in California to produce some really exceptional new varieties, and it's been out of reach for our program without having some funding to support that. So I brought in a graduate student and received some grants to work on this project. So we're hoping to also, in addition to developing wine varieties, continue to evaluate and develop some table grape varieties for the Midwest, especially thinking about, we have one grower who produces Somerset Seedless, which is a very small pink grape in Wisconsin, and he has a value on that crop at about $30,000 per acre. So that's pretty high value. So something we're excited about. And of course we make wine. So this is just to show you that our evaluation process is in the field looking at disease resistance, at horticultural traits, but we also have to go to the next step and actually make wine with our selections that we're making to find out, do they even taste good? And so I get a lot of volunteers, people who want to volunteer from our stakeholder groups to do this, and I say, you don't want to do this. We make about 100 wines, maybe 12 of them actually taste good or are worth pursuing in the next year. We spit out a lot of wine just as we spit out a lot of grapes in the field. Pretty high acid, not really all that enjoyable until we hit kind of gold. So kind of continuing the theme about people, I've got some really fantastic staff. Fortunately, I'm coming into a program that was pretty well established, and so I have some full-time staff. I have a husband and wife team, which has its pluses and its minuses, but they are very hardworking and they are kind of the state's experts. We have 11 acres under vine at our research site. The average planting in Minnesota for a grower is less than 1 acre. So we've already kind of accomplished more than what a lot of people are, what maybe 10 people are doing. I have an enologist, Drew, who's on staff, expert winemaker over 15 years of producing wines in places like Santa Barbara, California, and also has experience in Minnesota. Nicole joined us this year. She's looking to figure out where her next step in life is and got bit by the wine and grape bug. I have three grad students in my project, and I'll just mention what they're doing. Liu Yin is working on phylloxera resistance. Soon Li Tay is actually not in my lab group. He's in Jim Louie's group, but I always include him because he's doing a lot of work in powdery mildew resistance, and he's been a great collaborator. We were in the same lab group as graduate students, and I've transitioned into a new role. Anna is a master's student. She's working on the high-throughput phenotyping using digital image analysis. And then Lizzie is an expert in table grape production from Brazil and joined my lab and is working on the embryo rescue techniques. One of the great benefits of working on a fun crop like grape is that you can get a lot of volunteers. I've already indicated that a bit. So when we need hands, people show up. And so these are grad students who work on other projects who came in and plant grapes. It's usually because they know that we have wine stored away somewhere or access to other fruit. And it's fun. And we also have Ken. And I have to mention Ken. Ken's like 85. Emily, do you know how old he is? Like, he's ageless. Ken is the hardest working person on our crew. He comes usually one day a week. He does all of our culling in the field. I flag plants to take out, and Ken gets rid of them. And he works on a couple of different projects. He volunteers probably 60 hours a week on projects around the Twin Cities and maybe six of those on my project. And I don't know what we'll do without him when he decides to stop volunteering. I just want to acknowledge my funding sources. I've been really fortunate to get some funds from the Minnesota Department of Ag, who have invested in table grapes as well as wine grapes, seeing that we have a wonderful opportunity to grow those industries, and we can't do that without the varieties being developed in Minnesota. No one else is developing the cold, hardy stuff, and so that's a lot of pressure on our project, but at the same time, we have a lot of resources. And then Also, it'd be remiss not to mention VitusGen. That's really transitioned our project, and we've recently received news that we have a second round of funding for that project. So the next 4 years, we're going to continue to exploit all the resources available to us in that grant. And if you want to know more about growing grapes and how grapes have impacted the Midwest as well as just the northeast part of the United States, turn to the Northern Grapes Project, which was another SDRI project that ended, I believe, 2 years ago. A lot of really great information and impact coming out of that research. So without that, I'd be happy to take any questions. I think we probably have a minute and entertain any. All right, that was easy, thanks.